The following is a lecture given by His Holiness Jayapataka Swami on January 27, 1985 in Honolulu, Hawaii. The class begins with a reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 3rd Canto, Chapter 23, Text 44.
Bhajjanavadhatmanam Manaving suratot sukam Ramam niramayam reme Varshapugan muhurtavat Vibhajja
Having divided
Navadha
Into nine
Atmanam,
himself.
Manavim,
the daughter of Manu.
Devahuti,
Surata,
for sex life.
Utsukam,
who was very eager.
Ramam,
to his wife.
Niramayan,
giving pleasure.
Reme,
he enjoyed.
Varsha,
Pugan,
for many years.
Muhurta,
Vat,
like a moment.
Translation by His Divine Grace Srila Bhoicharan Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada.
After coming back to his hermitage, he divided himself, Kardama Muni, into nine personalities just to give pleasure to Devahuti, the daughter of Manu, who was eager for sex life. And that way he enjoyed with her for many, many years, which passed just like a moment. Translation. After coming back to his hermitage,
he divided himself
into nine personalities,
just to give pleasure
to Devahuti,
the daughter of Manu,
who was eager for sex life.
In that way,
He enjoyed with her
for many, many years,
which passed just like a moment. Purport. Here the daughter of Swayambhuva Manu, Devahuti, is described as Surot Utsuka. After traveling with her husband all over the universe, in Mount Meru and the beautiful gardens of the heavenly kingdoms, she naturally became sexually stimulated. And in order to satisfy her sexual desire, Kardama Muni expanded himself into nine forms. Instead of one, he became nine. And nine persons had sexual intercourse with Devahuti for many, many years. It is understood that the sexual appetite of a woman is nine times greater than that of a man. That is clearly indicated here. Otherwise, Kardama Muni would have had no reason to expand himself into nine. Here is another example of yogic power. As the Supreme Personality of Godhead can expand himself in millions of forms, a yogi can also expand up to nine forms, but not more than that. Another example is that of Sobari Muni. He also expanded himself into eight forms. But however powerful a yogi may be, he cannot expand himself into more than eight or nine forms. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, however, can expand himself into millions of forms. Anantarupa, innumerable, countless forms. As stated in the Brahma Sanghita, no one can compare to the Supreme Personality of Godhead by any conceivable energetic manifestation of power. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purport to text 44, chapter 23, canto 3 of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and the chapter entitled Devahuti's Lamentation. So now we're discussing the history of Kardama Muni, Devahuti, and ultimately the incarnation of Kapila Muni. As we remember that Kardama Muni had
had performed austerities for a long time. And finally, Vishnu himself appeared, or was it Brahma? Both. Appeared to him and blessed him. And then Karamuni married the daughter. He did not feel ready to immediately take up renunciation. There was still some seed of desire in his heart, but he didn't want to get married except to someone who was going to be able to assist him in becoming Krishna conscious or God conscious. Didn't want to marry just anyone. Didn't want to fall down from the spiritual path on the ultimate issue. So he had a blessing from Lord Vishnu to get Devahuti as a wife and to enjoy with her for some time, and then he would renounce, but that the Lord would himself become her son to give the transcendental science to the world. So now we're on the of the pastimes where Kardama Muni has taken Devahuti around the universe, showing through his mystic powers different aspects of the universe. And so now they're about to produce progeny. So they're enjoying their material happiness, sexual happiness in their Grihastha ashram. So there are many instructions contained within these pastimes. Of course, as we read on, we find out that in spite of, so nobody who can have a husband like Kardama Muni, especially in this Kali Yuga, who is able to take his wife not only to the movies or down to the drive-in or something in his Porsche. You see, Kardama Muni in a special airplane created from his mystic power, took his wife all over the universe, showed her that here are the heavenly planets, here's how the universe is set up. And then, to give her physical satisfaction, even expanded himself into 9 forms. So, there's no normal, there's nobody, practically speaking, in this world today who's got that type of mystical power. It's still, at the very end, Devahuti was lamenting that actually she had failed to get from her husband spiritual knowledge. And so in the end, they both did tapasya together to get the Lord as their son. So although, here it says, muhurtavat, material happiness may occupy our time and make it go very quickly, but then we're still right back where we started from. It just passes the time very nicely. It may be able to satisfy one's urges temporarily. And so that's good if someone's really agitated by material desires to experience what is the actual situation of material desire. What is its limitations? What is the extent of it? So here they're not leaving any stone unturned, so to speak. Within the regulative principles, they're fully experiencing material happiness in a bona fide way for a grihastha with the type of blessings and mystic powers that he has. But then, ultimately, of course, their goal is to become liberated. At least that was Devahuti's goal, and that is also his goal. So obviously, we can't imitate Kardama Muni in any respect. Similarly, we don't in our short life. They're living the lifespan of the demigods. So for them, many, many years is still just like only a few days as compared to us who are only living 60, 70, 80, 50 years or less. For us, a few years is a long time. It's a big percentage of our life. But for them, many years is nothing. Because they're living at that age, in that age, they're living in a totally different lifespan. Nonetheless, they're also trying to utilize the overall period of their life to become God-conscious. So this is one of the reasons why a person enters grihastha life. I remember once Srila Prabhupada asked me to leave the room. I was counseling one of his grihasthas, and he gave some advice on how to practice a grihastha life. He gave some book, different things. So when one's in grihastha life, there's a license for enjoying sense gratification. But on the ultimate issue, it's supposed to lead one to renunciation. One may directly enter renunciation, but that's very rare. Normally, the material desires plague one very strongly. And so it is a safer way to enter into grihastha life. If you have a desire for a progeny, to have followers, to have a family, then that can be dovetailed by being married and having children and raising those children in Krishna consciousness. In fact, in Sanskrit, the word putra or putri, the two names for son or daughter, means that the offspring or the putra, pu means hell and tra means to deliver. Putri, same thing only in the feminine. So someone who can deliver the parents. In this case, Devahuti's son was God himself. He was definitely capable of liberating everyone, what to speak of his parents. Bhaktivinoda Thakur had, as his son, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Chaitanya Das had as his son Srinivas Acharya, on the order of Lord Chaitanya. So sometimes even grihasthas are given order to have a child by the guru or by some great Vaishnava. And those children, the hope of the parent is that the child would be a transcendental personality. Of course, from this first connection, we'll find out that the offspring were girls. And then they did a special tapasya, a special penance, and later Lord Kapila, he came on his own free will. So, similarly, we should try to follow the overall life example of Karamuni and Devahuti when entering into the grihastha ashram, never losing sight, you see, of the ultimate goal of becoming Krishna conscious. But since our lifespan is so short, therefore, if we were to completely engage in this type of activities Karyamuni and Devahuti did of sexual relations for many, many years, with no holes barred, so to speak, then, because of our lack of austerities, the chance of us totally forgetting spiritual life would be very, very great. Kardamamuni for thousands of years had performed austerities. He had these mystic powers. So just like Bhima, he said, it's too difficult for me to observe every Ekadasi. Just give me one Ekadasi, once a year I can just do it, you know, do a super one. Because it's hard to keep track. And just he was more not so much in the brahminical mode, but more in the mode of passion, but a pure devotee, no doubt. So he got the benediction like in what in India is the hottest day of the year, in the month of May, that without water, without sleeping, 24 hours, continually just staying absorbed, chanting and fasting. And there's other, you see, rules that are to be followed. Then he observed that, you know, totally, Nirjala Ekadasi, known as the Pandava Nirjala Ekadasi. So then I said that, well, that's equal to 100 Ekadasi. So in case he missed any during the year, then he makes up for that. But say Kardamamuni, he didn't want to spend the whole life. His intention wasn't to spend the whole life in regulated grihastha life. He wanted to just experience all in just a few years and then get back. And then whatever was there, then go back totally into renunciation. Just get it over with. It was a little bit of a different kind of a situation. But he had that austerity behind him. Just like, for instance, there's a story about, it's not exactly the same, but there's a story about Shankara Acharya, that when he was preaching and defeating Buddhism, so there was this witch. She was like a mystically powerful yogini in the Buddhist religion, and he was having a debate with her. So she asked him some question. He had to defeat her in every respect in order to be able to establish his philosophy. She asked him some question, which the only way he could know was if he was a grihastha, if he had experienced sexual life. But since the age of 9 he had taken sannyas, there was no way that he could know that. So he was in a hard put situation, according to this story, to be able to answer that particular question. So he went into samadhi and meditation. He left his body in his spiritual form. And this, at that time, there was a king somewhere who was dying. So just after he left his body, he entered into the dead body. With his mystic power, brought it back to life. Nobody realized, it's like a person sick, and just at the very moment he died, he went in. So everybody thought the king recovered. So then he went in, and he also enjoyed with the king's wife. Experience what was that situation, and then the king went and died. The whole time Shankaracharya is in samadhi, goes back in, then he defeats that woman and establishes Vedic culture there. Of course, Shankaracharya is the incarnation of Lord Shiva, but at that time when they incarnate, it seems that they confined themselves to that particular experience as part of their pastime. Something beyond our understanding how that happens. But sometimes these great yogis and munis, they do some amazing things. But unless we're able to take people around the universe and expand ourselves into 9 forms and so on, we shouldn't just imitate and think, all right, so now I'll just, for 5 years, we'll just have a total honeymoon. And then after that, we'll renounce or something like that. Because we don't have that type of austerity in this modern world behind. Rather, I think everyone's already done the opposite. In many cases, not everyone, but in many cases, the material world is already there enjoying totally, and then sometimes people are a little bit frustrated, they come. Others are coming just out of knowledge, some are coming out of distress. All different situations are there. So Prabhupada has given us the opportunity of practicing Krishna consciousness, that whether we're in the grihastha ashram or whether we're in the renounced ashram, if we practice it perfectly, we can go back to Godhead at any time. This system is a little bit risky. If in the middle of it one were to leave the body, then one would have a hard time going back to Godhead, because at that time the consciousness is absorbed in the mood of sense gratification. Arvaskara Muni took that risk, but as I say, he again had, at that time was a different age and people lived the total lifespan. He had the blessings of Vishnu behind him and great austerities. And he also had the benediction that he was going to have Vishnu as a son. Well, from this first attempt, when only daughters were born, then the next time they were very careful to try to produce a son. And they're, of course, hoping that Vishnu would come in that next birth. So that's the basic kind of overview of the situation. The power of the yogis to expand themselves and do wonderful things, we can see that although these abilities are there, that ultimately the real thing is to connect with Krishna, who has got unlimited forms. Once we are reunited in our relationship as eternal servitor of Krishna, that is actually our complete perfection. And whether we have mystic power, at that time, of course, one gets the mystic power. Just like Narada Muni, he also said that when he went to see Krishna in Dwaraka, he went to each of the palaces of Krishna. And in each of the palaces, he found Krishna was doing something totally different. So yogi may expand into 9 or 10 or 8, whatever it is, forms. But they only have one consciousness. It's not like one form is feeling happiness, another is feeling... They may have multiple sensual perception, but the consciousness is one. So like if one is feeling pain, You know, that pain will be felt, you know, by all, right? Because it's one common consciousness. It's just they're able to somehow expand into 10 forms. But they won't be feeling different emotions. Emotionally, there'll be one consciousness. Just like we have, of course, two arms, but some, most people are like right-handed or left-handed, and some drummers, they become, what do you call it? Ambidextrous, where they can play different beats with each hand, you see, which normally, it's like they're both working independently, practically. So somehow they're able to do the similar type of thing where they're ambidextrous in each form, that each form can work simultaneously and do different things. But emotionally, the consciousness is still one person. When Krishna expands, each separate form is totally independent of the next, yet simultaneously the same. It's something which is totally inconceivable to even a great yogi, pure devotee, liberated, mystical, perfected person like Narada Muni. When he went around and saw Krishna laughing in one house and then feeling very compassionate in the next house and going in each one, displaying a totally different emotions. One place he's dressing up to go out and spy on, see what the citizens are thinking about, what's going on. One place he's, all the different kinds of pastimes are going on. Totally different from the next. Then he became totally amazed at the potency of Krishna. That how each of these forms, it's not like a yogi's expanding. He explained it, it's totally different. Krishna's, each expansion is full and complete. Well, the yogi's expansion is not actually independent of the others totally. They're not full and complete separate entities. He's still one entity with nine. He isn't able to make nine or whatever, eight forms. But the expansions of Krishna, they're unlimited. And each unlimited form has got the total potentiality. You see, it's the difference between having a multi-user computer where you have multi-terminals and having, you know, unlimited separate, like what do you call those, mainframes, computers. Each one has got the full potential, is not dependent on the other. So the yogi is kind of like a multi-terminal expansion. There's still one main, let me say that, CPU, central processing unit, but it has multi-forms. Where Krishna, he's totally independent. Each form, each one is simultaneously as good as the next and able to manifest its own pastimes without any dependence on any other form. So that's pretty inconceivable how that could happen, but we can get just some kind of an idea that Krishna's potency is unlimited and the yogi's potency is limited. They don't have the same potency as Krishna, but they definitely have more potency than normal conditioned human beings who haven't entered into the Brahminical culture. So rather than just trying to achieve that intermediate stage of just achieving mystic powers, which you can get automatically by being a pure devotee of Krishna, just like Narada Muni achieved. But Narada Muni, although he had those mystic powers, it wasn't that he needed to utilize them very often. You don't find, I don't know if there are any, so instances when Narada Muni felt the need for manifesting, although he mentioned he had them, sometime he must have tried them out because he knew the difference between his mystic powers and Krishna's. We don't find that he needed them. He rather depended upon Krishna. In his preaching, he would travel around and he would be preaching. And whenever it was necessary for his particular service, he used his power of traveling. Apart from that, he didn't use very much his mystic powers, except in rare instances, like when he gave Megrari the vision that what would happen to him in the future as the result of his karma and so on. So someone who's a pure devotee, they're given the mystic powers because they won't misuse them. They won't fall down even though they have them. And for some devotional service, sometimes they utilize them. But the yogis, sometimes they tend to, when they get mystic powers, to misuse them for sense gratification. And as such, sometimes they fall down from their platform. For instance, we find that in the life of Pandu, when he went into the forest hunting, there was a male and female deer having sexual intercourse, and at that time he shot the male, he shot the deer. It turned out that there were two husband and wife who, through their austerities, had achieved mystic powers, had turned themselves into the form of deer so that in public they could wander around in the forest and have sex, which they couldn't do in a human form because it would it wouldn't be appropriate at all. They want to maintain the Vedic standard. But unfortunately for them, they got killed. Of course, while they were dying, they cursed Pandu for shooting them in that state. In this way, sometimes we find that they get some mystic power and they use it for reasons which are not totally Krishna conscious. In the case of Kardama Muni, of course, as I said, it was a planned program. Just in a short time, he wanted to finish off his material desires and then to totally renounce. And he was assured that he would get liberation in the end. So with that kind of assurance behind him, so he took this particular method. Some of the other, they get mystic power, they totally lose sight of going back to Krishna. And they get absorbed in material activities. And sometimes they don't recover. It delays them for a long time. So Brahmuni, due to offenses of Vaishnavas, he left his austerities and he also got married to 49 queens. I think he... And it took him... We don't hear after that exactly about his spiritual practice. It took a long time to recover for him. But definitely he was delayed for a long time. His fall down was due to offending Garuda. Therefore, we're advised not to desire mystic powers. Today in America, people seem to have active exploring different forms of sense gratification. Some people are already tired of it. So now the movies are showing a trend towards mystic powers. The Force, so many other things. The people want to have mystic powers. These different movies that I hear about seem to be showing some kind of mystical things happening. So that's the normal trend. First one, one sense gratification in an ordinary way. Then to be able to have mystic powers, you can have sense gratification in a bigger way. Then the next stage after that is to want liberation. Some of the Buddhist yogis, they'd also get mystic powers. Therefore, they're able to convince people. Normal people, if they see some mystic power, they become awestruck, and then they, just like the scientists have been able to convince the people by showing some unusual feats through scientific and technological advancements, and more or less they've awestruck the people by their almost mystical power. Now we say, well, it's not mystical, it's just a manipulation of matter and science. Also, mystical means what? It's nothing except also the manipulation of matter. It's just that through vibration, through certain austerities, Prabhupada said it's a mechanism. If you know the mechanics of it, you can do it. But to get that type of mental and psychic control, to know those subtle mechanics of the material world, it takes austerities, it takes practicing that type of yoga, or it takes the special mercy of Krishna. But it's a mechanical apparatus. It's just that modern science, they may discover some of the mechanics of it. The mystic yogis, they discover it coming from a different direction. So they're coming up from the gross material direction, they're coming down from the spiritual into the subtle world, and knowing how to manipulate matter from the causal region, coming down into the world of effect. Now modern science has found that mind over matter, that some people are able to move little corks in the water and make them go here and there just by their thought process. So like this, the yogis, their concentration is so intense and they have the understanding how everything is coming down from the law of karma, from the causal plane into the phenomenal plane. And so they're able to utilize that that science, a subtle science, and to manipulate matter. But it's the same thing, you're manipulating matter. No matter how much you manipulate matter, whether you move pebbles or whether you move mountains, you're not going to be any more spiritually satisfied. It's simply a type of extended form of sense gratification. Ultimate satisfaction comes when we realize our real constitutional position. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, his followers are totally disinterested in mystical powers. In fact, sometimes Lord Chaitanya offered mystical powers to his devotees, practically as a test, but he offered that they could have. They didn't desire it. There's a story of Rasikanand, who was a disciple of Shyamananda Pandit. And at one time in Remuna, where Kirchhoff Gopinath is, he was sitting in the temple there. I haven't seen it written in a book, but this is what the local pandits of that temple explain happened. There's a special shrine to commemorate this pastime. That some mystic yogi had come into the town and he was flying around on a branch. It seems since he was flying on a branch that he wasn't actually a mystical yogi in the normal sense of the sattvic Astanga yoga process, because if you need to fly around on a branch, it would indicate that he was following the more tantric method by worshipping demigods. They get the empower branch. This is the original system. We know, of course, in Western history, the witches, they ride around on a broomstick or something. In India, they ride around upon a branch from a tree. So it seems that whatever that ancient system was, we find that the gypsies in Europe, they speak a language which is mainly Sanskrit derivative. They can understand Bengali or Hindi if you speak to them. They say that. So it seems that the similar type of tantric science was being practiced in ancient 400 or 500 years ago all over the world, but originally came from India. So this yogi was flying around on a branch. We'll call him a yogi, or this mystic, whatever you want to call him. And all the villagers were just dumbfounded because it's not the kind of thing you see every day. So they were overwhelmed. They ran to Rasikanand, who was their local Mahanta, their spiritual master, their spiritual guide. And they said, "You must come and see." They loved him as a Vaishnava. "You must come and see this yogi is flying around on a branch. This is wonderful." He's brushing his teeth that time early in the morning. He said, "This is nothing to worry about. It's not important." No, he's flying. "I tell you, it's nothing important. It's much more important to be Krishna conscious." No, he's flying. It's on a branch. It's no strings, nothing. So Rasikananda became very impatient. He took his twig. In India, they chew on a twig. Put it under his leg. He flew around the ashram 4 or 5 times, telling them, "I tell you, it's not important. You just be worried about being Krishna conscious." And he came back down, sat, and finished brushing his teeth. The villagers were amazed, you know. They got the point. So many of our great acharyas had these powers. They didn't, because the people then, they won't be thinking how to be Krishna, they think how to fly. Right? And they'll be obsessed with that idea. And, you know, if they die with that idea, then, you know, they may become a bird or something. They'll become a mystic yogi. It'll delay their spiritual progress. These mystic powers are simply a stall. In other ages, when you've got 10,000 or 100,000 years to work with, all right, so mystic powers, it's not that big a problem. But in this particular age, when you can die at any minute, when life is very short anyway, to be worried about these type of things, which are also very difficult to achieve because they are mechanical things, you have to, in the normal way of getting them, there's no guarantee that a person will get these powers. These TMers, they're doing this type of meditation to levitate, and practically speaking, because in spite of doing it for years together, they're normally able just to get up about a few inches and they fall down. They have to put rubber cushions. They fall down on their face. So they have the rubber cushions so they don't break their neck. Because they can't follow all those systems. It's amazing, even in this age, they can do that much. And they can even bounce. But even if they could fly, it's not the goal. You see. So Kardama Muni, after even he had so many mystic powers, he engaged ultimately in bhakti yoga. Everyone who really knows the science of yoga knows that ultimately you have to go into bhakti yoga and understand your relationship with Bhagavan. This is the ultimate perfection. So Lord Chaitanya, he was so merciful that he didn't want to distract anyone. In spite of offering, even he offered devotees, they didn't accept, you see. Somehow if they had it, all right. But they didn't even bother to show it to people. You hardly find any example of showing any mystic power amongst Lord Chaitanya's followers. Rather, they avoided the public fanfare. They avoided that type of public exposure. And they're always preaching the glories of Krishna, chanting Hare Krishna. Even though they would easily get mystic powers. But what was the use of showing it? People are all attracted just for those mystic powers. No one is going to just to be absorbed how to do this, how that. It'll be very hard to introduce Krishna consciousness to them. So, our process is not to try to achieve mystic power or even liberation, but to achieve pure Krishna consciousness. Now when we go back to Godhead, we leave this body. Now, some people, they may immediately transfer. But we find in the teachings of the Goswamis, Prabhupada also mentioned that when we go back to Godhead, that if we have any desires, we get stuck up on that particular plane. So if you could imagine, we're going back from the earth planet and we're going past the heavenly planets. So in one planet there, people all have mystic powers. In one planet, they're all beautiful gardens and beautiful men and women, and an ample opportunity for a sense gratification. You see, by their traveling to the heavenly planets, it showed here even Devahuti and Kardamuni, they became sexually agitated. When there's a very nice environment, very comfortable, very beautiful, sometimes that creates more sex desire. So, as we're going back to the spiritual world, if we happen to go on a visual tour, sometimes the yogis want to see what the universe looks like, and so they go around and they see a few planets on their way back to Godhead. But if we get, there's a danger, we'll get stuck up. If you think, oh, these mystic powers are far out, these are really nice, I'd like to have those. All right, then the next thing you know is there you're in Siddhaloka or Kinaraloka. You think, oh, these gardens in the heavenly planets are really nice. I'd like to stay here for a while. You get to take birth in the heavenly planets. And if you go through all the different planets, but your actual desire is fixed, I simply, there's no Krishna here. Where's Krishna? Oh, I don't see Krishna here amongst the yogis. I don't see Krishna here amongst the heavenly planets. I don't see Krishna here in Shiva Loka. I certainly don't see Krishna here in this Brahma Jyoti. Where is Krishna? Oh, here is Vaikuntha Loka, but where is Krishna? Where are the cowherd boys? Where's Mother Yasoda? Where's Lord Chaitanya and his Sankirtan party? Here is Narada Muni's here, but here he's very formal with Narayan, and four Kumaras are there, and Jai, but where's Gopal? Or where's Gauranga? If we have that type of desire, if we're already in that type of Sarupa Upalabdhi, where we identify directly in our relationship as a servant of Krishna in his Gopala form, Radhamada form, or with Lord Chaitanya, then that takes us back to Golok Vrindavan. Anywhere along the way where we're, if we're attracted in the material world to Karmakanda, Ganakanda, or to the majestic aspect in the spiritual world, or to just to merging into the Brahma Jyoti and the lower level than that, whatever it may be, we get stuck up there. For a pure devotee, they sometimes are able, after time, they're able to continue. But this is the thing. So right now, we have the opportunity, through Srila Prabhupada's books, through this movement of Lord Chaitanya, of reawakening our original consciousness as a servant of the original form of Krishna. And that can take us right back to Krishna, right back to Godhead. Now, even if we get stuck up, as long as we practice devotional service, of course, Prabhupada assures that in the end, one again gets an opportunity to continue. Even you take birth in the heavenly planets. Again, when you take birth in the earthly planet, you are able to take up your devotional service by being born in a good family or suitable for taking up devotional service. But there are definitely risks involved. In fact, I heard that one time Prabhupada said that he was expressing anxiety, that his devotees weren't concentrating enough upon being Krishna conscious. If somebody, we don't have that mystic power like Kartar Muni to experience everything in one life, so somebody still has this unfulfilled desire to enjoy sense gratification, they may have to take birth in the heavenly planets. But then by that time, or by the time you come back down to this earthly planet, Lord Chaitanya's movement wouldn't be here. His movement's here 10,000 years. What's 10,000 years in the heavenly planets? That's a few days. Nothing. There's a very great risk. You see, now we have this opportunity. It's just like when they advertise sail on between January 26th to 28th. If you go now while the sail is on, now you have to stand every opportunity. Now is the chance. Now if we just absorb ourselves in Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement, we just fall at the feet of Nittai Gaur and beg for their mercy. And somehow if they give us a drop of that spiritual ecstasy of pure love for Krishna, then immediately, without going through all these trials and tribulations, we can see that, well, this whole material world's happiness is just very insignificant compared to the joy, to the transcendental bliss of serving Krishna. And that's the best protection. You see, there's different ways of approaching it. One way is kind of through the school of hard knocks. And the other way is, all right, if you just, Lord Nityananda, give me a little drop of nectar. If you just flood me with so much happiness that I can't think anymore about anything else, that I just, the material happiness no longer has any attraction for me because of you giving me the pure happiness of Krishna consciousness. You see, that is the best immunization. You want to get the vaccination from the material attraction. The best way is to get absorbed in transcendental ecstasy. And to do that, we have to have a very strong desire. In a few days or weeks or months or years, if we're very determined, and if we get that somehow or another, if we can just convince Lord Nityananda that we don't want anything else but that, he should please give us that little drop of mercy. Well, if somehow or another, because he's unlimitedly merciful, he doesn't consider that this person's qualified or unqualified, he's very liberal in giving that mercy. Well, if someone just has the desire for it, Lord Nityananda, he's been known to give. So it's very promising if we put our faith in Lord Nityananda, if we put our aspirations on his lotus feet to give that mercy. And if we get that, then after that it's smooth sailing. Then material happiness does seem very insignificant. And all we have to do is just avoid too much association with materialistic things, which will somehow just bring us into some clouded condition where we forget our spiritual perspective and start acting just mechanically again on the material platform. We just have to avoid that type of situation and continually engage in devotional service. So with that little drop of nectar, that's what every devotee prays for. Kripa bindu diya. Give me that drop of mercy. That drop of mercy, which is the mercy of Lord Nityananda. Guru is, of course, the representative of Lord Nityananda. He can also request Lord Nityananda to give that mercy. And so when we get that, then we don't have to go through so many material experiences and become renounced and detached, and then engage in devotional service and austerities in that kind of more tedious way. Directly, we can be very fixed up on the spiritual platform by achieving that ecstasy of devotional service. We get a little taste of it in our kirtans, sometimes in devotional service. We get a little glimpse of that transcendental happiness, and that is enough, of course, to give us even more enthusiasm. But if we totally desire that mercy from Lord Nityananda, why wouldn't He give? He's so merciful. He gave Jagai Madai, and they didn't even have a desire for it. If we have a desire for it, then why wouldn't He give us the mercy? So we should fix our mind, not for any material reason we'd want the spiritual happiness, but just so that our mind is totally fixed. Because we know that, like little children, always looking, where's the sweet, where's something to eat, they're a little restless. Like this, our mind is immature, it's a little restless, it gets disturbed sometimes by material allurements. How is it going to be possible to satisfy the mind and senses? We know it's not possible by material means, and we lack sometimes the determination to do it spiritually. So the only hope for us is to get the mercy of Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda, the Panchatattva. Because by their mercy, then immediately we can be absorbed in transcendental bliss, and that's our best immunization. The only thing that can potentially drag us down from that transcendental platform is if we commit offenses to the Vaishnavas, or if we're careless and inadvertently we allow weeds to grow up. So, this is the system Lord Chaitanya has given. It's definitely the most shortcut. We simply be absorbed in transcendental ecstasy. And this way, you don't have to go through this type of material sense gratificatory distractions. One can very simply practice their Krishna consciousness and then go back to Godhead. That's the unlimited mercy of Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada to bring us the mercy of Lord Nityananda here in the Western world, where people are far removed from spiritual life. So He gave the process, chant Hare Krishna, dance in ecstasy, feast, and by people they didn't even know the philosophy, didn't know anything. They weren't even following any principles, but by chanting and feasting on Krishna Prasadam and dancing while chanting Hare Krishna, they started to feel transcendental happiness. And having felt transcendental happiness even a little bit, even for a few moments, then their mind became fixed. Oh, this is something really wonderful. And then they start reading the books and they become... So our process is somehow or another to get people to chant, get them to dance, get them to take Krishna prasadam. Those who are, you see, the general people, they're not very philosophically inclined nowadays. Those who are, of course, let them come and we'll can deal with them philosophically. But in generally, our process is to just somehow or another engage people in devotional service. By that, they become purified and they taste some spiritual peace of mind, happiness, ecstasy in some cases. And then once they feel a very strong connection with Krishna through that type of, through those different types of practices, then we teach them how to avoid weeds and offenses, how to maintain their devotional service through the process of regulative principles or sadhana. And once they achieve then a very fixed state of experiencing transcendental bliss, then their responsibility is to carry out the order of the spiritual master. Of course, externally, they'll always engage in chanting and hearing and devotional practices to show a good example to others. But their primary duty at that time then is fulfilling the order of the spiritual master over all other duties. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adaita Gadadhar Shri Vasudi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Any questions?
Are there any devotee prayers? Are there any
Well, they're all devotees.
Well, listen.
They're called Sakam Bhaktas. I mean, they're devotees, but they have material desires. Niskam and Sakam. Those who have desires, they go to the heavenly planets. Anyone in the heavenly planets is a devotee. Deva means you're a devotee of Vishnu. If you have material desires, you're not a devotee, then you go to those places in the lower planets where there are also sense gratification, but they're not devotees.
But why can't they go back to Godhead? Why do they have to come back here and then go back from here?
Well, it's been described in different ways. One is that when you're in the heavenly planets, the comforts and the sense gratification is so all-pervasive that one doesn't really feel the urgency. One doesn't feel that type of intense need for engaging in self-realization. It's just like you find it's more difficult to preach, say, to Americans than people in the third world, possibly because they have enough money. They're a little more proud, self-reliant. People, when they're poor, even when you do Sankirtan, I've heard it many times that it's actually the poor people are easier to approach, even though they don't have money. They're easier to approach. They're not. By sense gratification, person becomes a little bit proud, become a little bit aloof. So you can imagine that in the heavenly planets, you have a situation where there's practically no suffering. Practically, the only in Janaloka, like the suffering they experience is they see that in other planets people are suffering and that they feel bad about it. And you go higher up than that, and then they're even further removed from the suffering. So, in that environment, to become Krishna conscious, it requires a long time of meditation, different things. And there are those who do that. But normally, to go back from the heavenly planets, then they'll start planet hopping. They'll start to, by their austerities, go up to Brahmaloka, Satyaloka. And then they'll stay with Lord Brahma. Now, when Lord Brahma dies, and he lives a long time, when he goes back, then those people with him on his planet, they get to go back. So at that time, many of the siddhas and others who have mystic power, they try it at the last part of the universe to get up to Satyaloka. And those who make it, they're home base. They get to go back to Godhead. But those who don't make it, then they have to wait till the next creation of the material universe. So that way is something far in the future. We know that even when Lord Brahma goes to sleep at night, the residents of the Satyaloka, Radha Muni explained that he was in the body of Vishnu, but he was conscious for those millions of years. It just went very quickly for him. And then again, they came out. He didn't lose his consciousness. But from this earthly planet, the facility of going back to Godhead. At the end of life, this is like the special loophole that as a human being, there's not so much sense gratification. There's not a little suffering. You can see suffering. If you're not even experiencing it so much, you can see it. It's there in the world, right before your eyes. And most people experience some suffering, especially now in Kali Yuga. Similar, but there's not so much suffering that even amongst the suffering, there's some happiness. Like I said, in a hellish planet, it's so hellish that it's just so horrible that you can't think about sense. You just want to get out of that place. And you can't concentrate upon sadhana or some kind of spiritual practices so much. It's very difficult. It's just too hellish. The pain is just too great. So this is described as the ideal place for going back to Godhead. Krishna said, if anybody remembers Krishna at the time of death, they'll come to him, no matter where they are. But we're advised that in the heavenly planets, apparently, they don't always think about Krishna because of the sense gratification. They get distracted. where if we are Krishna conscious in this planet, well, it's a good opportunity to remember Krishna and go back. If you remember Krishna at the time of death, you go to him. If you're thinking of something else, you go there. That's a universal. Krishna wasn't speaking for one country or one person or one place. His speaking was universal. So, and then the demigods, they live for a long time. So at the end of their life, if they think of Krishna, they can go back. It's just that apparently there's dangers, and you have to live a long time. It's a long time. In a very comfortable situation. It's advised that, in fact, the demigods, they prefer taking birth here to practice the devotional service. Especially they're crying to be here when Lord Chaitanya's movements, because in such a short time you can go back to Godhead. I don't know if they answered it.
Jara, you're talking about how a yogi can extend himself many times. But what about a Vaishnava? I don't know if Kardana Muni was on that platform or not, but a pure Vaishnava, can a pure Vaishnava extend himself more than nine times? It's like if there's a pure devotee and he's being worshipped, and his murti is on the altar, and we understand that he's not different than that murti. Say there's 100 or 1,000 murtis. Does that mean that that pure devotee has expanded himself 1,000 times? It's like in each temple, there might be 1,000 temples, and each deity is independent personality, but when he's just the same person.
Well, he's expanding his material body this many times. The spiritual form is not limited. Spiritual form is beyond time and space. It's on the transcendental platform. So there's not that separation.
Can a pure devotee do more than 9 times, or is that just a yogi?
You're talking about the physical, the material body? Physical. But it's not a physical, you know.
Spiritually physical, the tangible. Just like, I think...
the spiritually physical.
I mean, the tangible, you know, just like the government said, God's body was spiritual. In the same way, the deity, we say that the deity of Prabhupada is also... Isn't that Prabhupada's deity?
Well, that's an archa-avatar. You're calling Prabhupada from the spiritual platform to be present within that form.
Yeah.
So that's can be done a limited number of times. You see, there's two different ways to approach it. One is someone who's in the spiritual world and has a form like Vishnu's. That means he's already has his Sarupa city where he's in his two-armed or four-armed form. So you can't limit that form. It's not, that entity can be simultaneously present. You can communicate with that person. He's on the transcendental platform. Beyond the material limitations. And that's one angle of vision. Other angle of vision is even if someone was in the material world as a pure devotee, but was still not manifesting any type of transcendental opulences like that, but through the super soul, you see, Krishna is present everywhere, so through the super soul, that devotee can understand, just like this electrical, just like telephonic connection. You have a line here and one in Los Angeles. So super soul is in every atom, he's in every heart, he's in the heart of the pure devotee. So if one has direct connection with Krishna, then he would know everything through Krishna. It's just a difference, you know, knowing it from Krishna or knowing it directly. It's no basic difference. It amounts to the same thing. When we offer our prasadam to the spiritual master, even when people offer the prasad to their ancestors, the ancestors are not pure devotees. In fact, they're offering, they might be in hell. But through the process of mantra and through our meditation, they get the benefit of having of that prasad offered to them through the super soul, through... Now, the pure devotee is in a totally different situation. But in any case, whichever way it's going through the devotee to Krishna, worship is accepted by Krishna. There's no limitation of the material time or space. It's not that you can only have 10 murtis of Prabhupada after that, just no more expansions allowed. But this is an archa avatar. And what specifically is being talked here is when the body expands into 10 different forms. And each form is, you know, just like in some time, I forget, there was one yogi who was fighting a battle and he divided himself into 10 forms. And each one had a sword and they were fighting like that. I think some demon did that also with Krishna. So that can be done by these yogis. They can expand themselves into different forms and they can all be, they're all doing, of course, they're all doing one thing, they're all fighting. Or they're all, whatever they happen to be doing. In this case, they're all acting in family activities and sexual activities, whatever. They're all doing one basic activity. This is on a material platform. These are material bodies. Spiritual bodies don't do these type of things. It's not a body, it's a spiritual rupa. You say deho. Deho means body. Sukha sarir and stola sarir. Gross and subtle bodies. A body is a covering. But when you don't find, you say here siddha sarup, siddha rup, the spiritual form. For when referring to the form of the soul, it's not a body. It's the form of the soul. It's like you have the form of your hand and the covering of your glove. So there's a difference. When you're discussing with the coverings, with these bodies, the yogi is able to expand even his physical body up to 8 or 9 times through mystic power. That's called mind over matter. On a far different level than what they're investigating in now modern science. But the spiritual, on the spiritual platform, there's no limitation. If Krishna wants, he can empower a soul to do anything. That's called shaktavesh. And simultaneously, one can be conscious of what's going on throughout the entire material universe. So Vyasadev saw simultaneously the material worlds, the spiritual world, everything. He's an individual soul, empowered. So simultaneously, on the spiritual platform, you can see you're not limited. Your every sense is interchangeable, just like Krishna's. There are ultimately some limitation, but of an individual soul relative to Krishna, even on the spiritual platform, but it's in specific areas. This wouldn't prove, in either case, but it wouldn't prove a limitation. Either if you consider that directly the spiritual master is present in his deity, or that it's being transmitted through the agency of the supersoul, in either case, it's no difficulty.
When the yogi expands to 9 different forms, he still has just one soul, and
right.
The soul doesn't.
Soul doesn't. Soul's not subdividing. The Atma is one.
Now, in case of a pure devotee who you say has the body of Vishnu, is not different in that way. Uh-huh. Does that mean that he becomes all pervasive as well?
His body is,
or is he just conscious of
like that? Vishnu. Not exactly the same.
So does that mean that it's all pervasive, like, you know, with his picture? I mean, does that mean that he's conscious of the picture, or does that mean that he's...
So it means that his picture on the transcendental platform, anything to do with the liberated soul, is connected with him. Even in a material world, it's known that physically, that... As you come up to the absolute platform, everything does become one in the absolute. But even within that oneness, there's also variegatedness. Even we find in the ancient cultures, like in South America and the Caribbean, they take a doll of someone materially and they do voodoo and things, because there's a relation between a form or thought or an object of a person and the person, even in a material platform. What to speak of on the spiritual platform is direct. The picture of the guru, picture of Krishna is connected.
The spirit soul is described as being 10,000th the size of the tip of the hair, but is it different when one's on the spiritual platform, or is it that it becomes just caught?
And that's the size of the dormant soul. When you get your siddha sarup, then you have your spiritual form, which is, well, relative to whatever situation you're in. At that time, it's not...
But it never becomes obvious.
Not in that sense. It's all pervasive. Wherever Krishna is, the devotee's there. Simultaneously, the soul can appear in more than one place under certain circumstances and be performing different pastimes.
Just like
in the spiritual world, huh?
That's right. Just like the deity is looking at us. Deity is there, Krishna is there, and he's looking at us. Is it the same way that the spiritual master is there on the altar? He has mercy in his picture and he's looking at us?
Why not? Therefore, we fortify our intelligence with the words of the spiritual master and the instructions from the Shastras and the teachings from the Vaishnavas that gives us transcendental intelligence. Just like someone may be a PhD or a doctor or some big lawyer and he may be very intellectual and very intelligent on that level. And there may be someone who is just like that story you must have heard about the boatman and the scholar. You heard that. No bhakta. You don't tell him these stories. Well, one might be very simple in terms of material sophistication, but maybe very practically intelligent. So if we have the advice from the spiritual master, they can tell you the story sometime of the boatman and the scholar. It's on video, I think, even the drama. With that very practical intelligence, you can distinguish what's a weed. Just like a gardener, he's also intelligent, but his may not be very sophisticated in some cases, but he's very practically intelligent. So that type of intelligence the devotee has is very practical. It may not be the most sophisticated. May also be that they're not also sophisticated or really intelligent devotees in that sense, but in general they have a very pragmatic understanding of life, very pragmatic understanding of what's a weed in the spiritual life by having received so many instructions from those spiritual sources. So you should fortify yourself by reading the scriptures, by listening to the classes, by listening to your spiritual master. And this way you'll get more and more intelligence how to avoid the different pitfalls in spiritual life. Yes? It's number one. Can be. Depends on the gravity of the offense. The elevation of the person you're offending, but for any Vaishnava, it can cause fall down. It's compared with Vaishnava parad matal hati upare ba chinde tar sukhi jayapata. It's like an elephant pulling out banana tree right from the root, ripping it out and throwing it down, or any tree. So that means for some time the leaves may stay green, but after some short they'll become dry and fall out. It's pulled out from the root. I mean, if you cut, it might grow up again. If you cut a tree, sometimes it grows up. You pull it out from the root and just throw it down, then it's called the mad elephant offense. So you have to guard from that very carefully. She never stops seeing the good qualities in Vaishnava. Some quality may become visible, which is not so good sometimes. But if a person is a Vaishnava, we should never lose our sight of the good qualities that person possesses. The bad qualities can be purified. So when a person only starts seeing the bad qualities, not able to see the good qualities, becomes offensive, then it's very dangerous. Pardon?
What if the devotee is very offensive and talented to us, probably, because he's a little bit
Vaishnava? You see, sometimes people consider
Like if you say that this person shouldn't be listened to, or this person's inimical to Prabhupada, or this person's... Somebody thinks that that's not an offense, you see. Sometimes people try to get sympathy, saying, just see, because they say don't go to those people, they say don't listen, or they say they're inimical to Prabhupada, some cases, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it says anyone who cannot appreciate the good devotional service of another, who's envious of that, is not a Vaishnava. So it doesn't mean that every one of Prabhupada's godbrothers is necessarily a Vaishnava. It doesn't mean that every one of our godbrothers is necessarily a Vaishnava. They might not have come up to the platform of being a Vaishnava. They may have fallen down from the platform of being a Vaishnava by their offenses. Normally, no one's going to take a risk of criticizing the spiritual master's brothers. We don't take, this is too big a risk socially and Vedically, we just don't do it. It's dangerous. Maybe somebody has that type of insight. They think that, well, this person doesn't show the qualities of the Vaishnava. So they may say something like that. Other people may just maintain the social structure. They don't say that. Someone may say that later on just for the sake of preaching, because someone, although technically they may not actually be a demon, but they may be acting practically like a demon because they're acting inimical to a preaching, preaching of Krishna consciousness or a preaching movement, which is definitely not the activity that a Vaishnava should or would do. But later on, that person may somehow or another readjust his vocabulary in terms of describing that particular person, or he may have said something like that just to be a little graphic in terms of defending the spiritual life of others. Maybe it was over-enthusiastic in some cases, maybe in other cases it was realistic. But just to get the kind of, attention or sympathy, the people who they'll try to expose that, we'll just see how can someone offend a Vaishnava. This all ploys and somehow or another getting people to listen to that other person and ultimately to come into that particular camp, It's not, just like for instance in the Krishna conscious movement, we don't discuss Prabhupada's godbrothers. You brought it up, so we're discussing. You see, we have plenty of things we're trying to preach. We're trying to expand Prabhupada's mission that he started, the mission of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. We don't have time to just sit around and discuss the bad or good relative qualities of different other people who are not really doing so much in the spiritual activities of spreading Krishna consciousness in this world. But other people, their preaching is based upon somehow identifying with Prabhupada and bringing him into their, and trying to gain some credibility from having some relation with Prabhupada. And then the other way that they have is then by trying to discredit people if they don't accept whoever they're trying to promote. But the basic thing was that Prabhupada was very clear. He wanted that all of the followers of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur should work together. This is his basic stand. We should all work together. If you don't want to work together, if you don't want to cooperate together, all right, then we're separate. And we're going to establish a cooperative movement as the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. If you want to cooperate with that, work together. We have branches all over the world. We got the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Step forward, come on. If you don't want to cooperate, you want to set up your own independent camp, you don't want to follow Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur's order to work together, we don't want anything to do with you. Apart from socially being polite, if you're not inimical, but this is the basic thing. There's no reason that anyone should not cooperate with Srila Prabhupada. His movement is offering the best opportunity in the whole world for becoming Krishna conscious. Hare Krishna.
Oh. one of the ends at the Vaishnava, specifically if one of the things to say about a god brother or one spiritual master, then that can oftentimes that person naturally be his material desires will very much increase. Is that true?
If you had the mercy of Lord Nityananda, that mercy is that you're feeling spiritual ecstasy and that immunizes you from material attractions. So it doesn't matter whatever Vaishnava. In fact, in the 11th or 12th, 11th canto Bhagavatam, it mentions even a Uttama Adhikari, if he offends the Kanishtha Adhikari. Say that for some reason a very exalted devotee became envious of a neophyte devotee's sincerity or something like that. It's practically impossible to happen. But in case it were just to happen, even in that case, that a more advanced devotee, just like Lord Ram told Hanuman, that don't be proud and not give that little spider was throwing little pieces of dust and Hanuman was throwing big boulders. And so Hanuman said, like, get out of the way. And Ram is saying, no, he's working with his full enthusiasm and energy. He's no less than you are. So somehow if a more advanced devotee might consider himself far more exalted than some, say, neophyte devotee, and somehow obstruct the devotional service of the neophyte just out of false ego. Even for that offense, you can fall down. What to speak of if you're offending someone more, you see, any Vaishnava. So certainly the social, the Vedas say that one should see even one's own godbrother who is more elder and who is more senior, more Krishna kind, you should see him almost equal with the spiritual master. And the Vedic, that's your own godbrother. And so the godbrother of your spiritual master should normally be respected. It's a spiritual uncle. There's a difference in relationship. Again, Prabhupada clarified in the Adi Lila Part 3 that if somebody is inimical of the devotional service of his godbrother, that it's not a Vaishnava quality. Vaishnavas are not envious. Materialists are envious people. A person is a materialist and you offend them, there's no offense. Or a person is a Vaishnava but he has a materialistic attitude and you warn people to avoid that materialistic attitude, it's also not an offense. But one should definitely, from the Vedic social point of view, one should avoid offending the older Vaishnavas or the godbrother of the spiritual master, as one also would avoid offending the spiritual master. And if you do offend anyone, then if you'll lose the mercy of Nityananda, then naturally you're more open for falling prey to sense gratification. This is something that's very difficult for someone else to judge, except for the spiritual master.
Two questions. Is it an offense to criticize a devotee if he's doing something wrong? And second of all, in the Bhagavad Gita it says that whatever service one renders is never lost or diminished. Is Vaishnava Brahma an exception to that rule?
The last part?
Is Vaishnava Brahma an exception to the rule